Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master, Paramahansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, humbly we bow to you all. Help us to attune ourselves to your divine presence within, that everything we do will be a perfect expression of your infinite love. Om peace. Amen. But what we're doing is we're taking the oratorio that Swami Kriyananda wrote, which is the musical expression of the life of Christ, and it's often performed, and we listen. And then some of the songs are part of other ceremonies that we sing, but this is the only time when everybody gets to do all the music. And so it's not a performance of any kind. It's a sadhana for us to enjoy ourselves. And the way that we've developed doing it over a number of years is we've taken the oratorio, which is about an hour and a half of continuous music, including some instrumentals. We only do the ones with words. We don't do the instrumentals. It's about an hour and a half of continuous music if it's performed. And we divide it into three sections, partly just because most of us couldn't sing for an hour and a half without stopping, and also to give me an opportunity to sort of set the stage and talk a little bit about what's going on in the story, what Jesus is doing. And what we're trying to accomplish in this experience is to realize that music is a more direct language than words. And it's not merely the beautiful poetry that Swami wrote, which in and of itself is extremely enlightening, but also the actual vibrations of the melodies communicate the message that each of those parts of Jesus' life, the early years of his mission, Mary's elation when she knew she was going to be the mother of Jesus, the trials and tribulations, of course, of the end of his life, the jubilation of the resurrection, all of those, we can say those as ideas, but the melodies are also the vibratory expression of those ideas. Because even language itself, we're just putting sound, but it's the thought, and behind the thought is the feeling and the consciousness, and it's the consciousness that begins it, and then we finally find a way to say it, usually not quite as satisfactory as what we first feel, and then try to communicate with each other. Music, by contrast, it doesn't require when we speak in language, first of all, we have to understand each other's language, just to begin with. And also, people will have very different nuances to different words. As Swami says, the word home, for example, if you grew up or were denied a comfortable, happy home, the word home might for you be a sense of poignant loss, where for someone else, the word home might be a sense of joy and security. And so someone can just refer to home, and people can have very different experiences because there's so many filters between you and words. But when we get closer to our origin point, we get closer to the Om vibration, which is the substance of which creation is made, and we ourselves are actually the sound of Om. A healer friend of mine, I knew from many years ago, she was a sound healer in a very unusual way, and in the same way that sometimes people can read auras, she would hear the essential vibration of people, and she would be able to tell from that vibration what was out of balance, and then she would try through various, having them listen to certain sounds and so on, try to put their sound vibration back into balance. It was an extremely interesting form of healing in which she herself was very effective. She was never able to train others, but she was able to do it herself. So when Swami Kriyananda went to Israel in 19, it was probably 85, I think, was the year that this happened. 83 might have been more accurate. I'm not entirely certain. I think it was 83, actually. Yes. And when he came back from the Holy Land, the way he put it was this. He said, the experience was complete within him. He had felt no compelling need to communicate it with others. He felt content. But after he'd returned to Italy from having been in Israel, he essentially woke up in the morning with melodies in his mind. And this is often how it is with Swami. The melodies just come to him. And the melodies represented in sound the vibration of the different places he had visited. And those different places represent, of course, the different stages of Jesus' life. And he said he just got a tape recorder and whistled the melodies into the tape recorder and received like 20 or 25 melodies just all at the same time. And then he saw that this was a way that he could take the experience he'd had and he could give it to others. And when he came home from Europe, he went to Holy Land and then from Europe, and he gathered some of us together in the ashram we had in San Francisco then, which was this big house on Broadway up in Pacific Heights. In his top floor room, there was a small group of us around, and he had this little keyboard, this very inexpensive little plink plink. And he was so thrilled telling us, you know, here, and this is what it was, this is the sound of the Holy Sepulchre. And he went, ding, 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 like that. And we would all say, oh, yes, sir, that really communicates, you know. Later after, you know, you learn with creative people when to criticize and when to support. Later, when it was all, when he'd finished and we were performing it, and we sort of laughed about how we heard it. And he said he knew that was true, but he heard it in his mind as it all finally came out. He saw where the melodies were going. And then he sat down and spent quite a few months writing words and creating harmonies, writing instrumentals in some cases, you know, just turning it into an actual performable piece. But it all began with those fundamental melodies. Melody, he said, is what communicates the aspiration in music, which is why it's the message and the aspiration, which is why there's so little melody these days. People don't know what they want to say and they have no aspiration. So there's no melodies. They just go up and down without going anywhere, which is pretty much what's happening. So we've been performing this oratorio for quite some time, and then some years ago, maybe even as long as 20 years ago, we had this thought that it was frustrating only to listen to it. Everybody wanted to sing, but few of us were good enough to really stand up in front of others and do it. So we started doing it like this. One last point, just for clarity. In almost all cases, Swamiji receives the melody first, and then he understands what it says, and then he puts words on it, because words are less direct than the melody. So the only exception to that is, after we'd been doing the oratorio for a few years, Swami wrote what are called the recitatives, the little pieces, very short songs in between. And he said he did those from the words first, because he was going to the Bible, and he needed to create conceptual bridges between the pieces, so it had to be words first, and then he put the melody on it. He corrected me on that one, so I wanted to make sure that was true. But in otherwise, and sometimes it's kind of amusing, a song, one of his songs, which is really beautiful, is called Jenny Will Love Me, and it's a beautiful melody, and then the words are slightly comical, because the song is called Jenny Will Love Me, and it's about this man who's fantasizing that Jenny will love him, because there really isn't a chance that Jenny's going to love him. And it's sort of a ironic song, because the melody's so lovely. Swami performs it on one of his albums, and I said, you know, that song doesn't really work. Because unless Jenny is a complete idiot, anyone who could write and sing a song like that deserves to be loved by Jenny. And he said, and if Jenny were so unworthy of his affection, then he wouldn't be loving her like that. And Swami laughed and said, I know, he said, I've thought of that objection myself many times. But then he sort of shrugged and he said, but those are the words that came. So it's not for him an intellectual process. It's more just like it has a flow and this is how it works. So for the way we will do the program today, it's like this. I will talk for 20 minutes or so just to tell us about Jesus and be ready. Then we'll sing together, a number of songs, a dozen songs or so, and we'll just go straight through them. Todd is on the piano. We'll have a few of our best singers on the microphone so that there'll be a nice basis for the sound. There's been endless discussion about, we don't have as much choir here today as we sometimes do, but when we have a lot of choir here, there's an endless discussion between whether do we sing parts or whether we all sing melody. So I'm just going to tell you what the point of the day is, and we can try to figure it out. Some people are absolutely convinced that the melody alone doesn't communicate the way all the harmonies do. The balance against that is when we first started doing this, and Chaitanya still lived here, Patrick Mahoney, and he has an exquisite singing voice, but he's a tenor, and he always sang the tenor parts. And when we ran this through and he sang the melodies, he said it was the first time he sang all the melodies. And he stated very strongly that the experience of singing all the melodies was entirely different than when you sing the harmonies, because the essential song is in the melody and everything supports it. So after that, I became quite definite that everyone should sing melody, and then choir members started complaining. So inasmuch as you can't please everyone, I will bring you into the reasoning and I'll let you make up your own minds. If the harmonies get too strong, the people who are not as familiar with the music lose touch with the melody. So if some of you really want to sing harmony, please try to sit together in your parts so that we don't have one, tenor bellowing it out over here and one bass over here, and then the people around them lose the melody. That's one point. And just pay attention. Again, our group is particularly small today. We don't have as many choir members. But pay attention. And if you can feel that the room is losing the melody, then just go back to the melody. Okay? And when we have the shorter songs, the recitatives especially, we'll do them through twice without hesitating. We'll just do it once and then we'll do it twice. That's because both the words and the melody on those songs are very, very deep. And I find that if you do it twice through, you can get a lot more from it. Once through, at least to my experience, you're just beginning to feel it, and then it's over. I find that when it's performed, too. So I guess that's just my preference. When we do sing, we want to stand as close together as we can, because if our voices come together, it's much more powerful than if you're standing by yourself. And if you're not a good singer or aren't as familiar with the music, you might as well be in the middle of it. And then whatever you can contribute, at least you'll be surrounded. So we'll sort of figure the logistics of that. You have a piece of paper with all the words on them. Oh, and the other thing is, so what we do is I talk, we sing, we meditate for about 15 minutes, just to sit in silence, and then we take about a 10-minute break so you can get a little air, walk around. But we try to keep that break as much as possible in silence, so that we hold the mood. And it takes us pretty much until about 2 o'clock to finish this. But the time goes really fast, you'll see. Okay, are we all ready? So. The first, interestingly, just I want to say, when the first time I did this many years ago, and when I studied the oratorio and I tried to think about how we would divide it up, because I knew we couldn't do it straight through. And I sort of just looked at the songs and their natural progression, and I put names to each of the sections and so on, and I just did that all on my own. And then later I went to Swami and I sort of pointed out to him how nicely the songs all divided. And he appreciated that, because it's not like, it wasn't a conscious thought on his part, but an oratorio is from the beginning to the end of Jesus' life. So what we're going through is the descent of the Spirit, the call of the devotee, God's response, and it just has a natural rhythm that you see afterwards, is what we're working with. So Swamiji also called this, Christ lives in the Holy Land and in you. And his intention with that name was also to counter what he felt was the attitude of many of the fellow pilgrims he met when he was in Israel, and of course the attitude of many more traditional devotees of Jesus, which is because so much of the teaching of Jesus was the example of his life, there's a tremendous inclination to make the relationship with him defined by that, by the details of his personality and of his life experience. There's nothing really wrong with that, per se. Christianity, ironically, considering how some Christians feel about Eastern religions, is the most guru-oriented religion in the world. And that kind of devotion to Jesus is extremely powerful. But what we need to add to that is the realization that what Jesus was, is Jesus personified our own capabilities. And because he himself was a self-realized master, a Christ, and did have that infinite capacity to uplift and enlighten us even to this time, completely transcending all time and all space, transcending death in every respect, that personal devotion to him is an extremely powerful way that we attune ourselves. Love is an enormously unifying force. And Jesus lived, and Jesus' consciousness as an individual expression of spirit is there. It's exquisitely beautiful and irresistibly lovable. And so there's no fault in that very personal relationship. The more natural and wholehearted our love can be, the more powerfully God can reach back to us. St. John says in the Gospel, as many as received him, to them gave he the power to become the sons of God. And so that word received is, of course, the entire key, which is what does it mean to receive him? And why do so few receive him? And so when we put ourselves in relationship to Jesus, it's not so much about how great and glorious he was and the way, and I'll talk more about this toward the end, you know, the way he sacrificed and suffered for us and all that, with all that gratitude, which is also real. We have that in the Festival of Light. Here then is the fourth and last stage of the soul's long journey, from a life of infinite joy and freedom in God, willingly to embrace limitation, pain, and death for the salvation of others. Here then is the, you know, such always has been the sacrifice of the great masters for the world. That's Christianity completely. And Swami carried it forward into the Festival of Light, because there is that extraordinary sense of gratitude which creates within us a great deal of receptivity. Gratitude, respect, leads to the right kind of friendship and love. But then Swami adds, here then is the fourth and last stage of the soul's long journey, which is, it isn't merely that we love and revere Christ for his sacrifice, it's the roadmap of where we have to go. We have to meet him. That was John's words. To all those who received him, he gave the power to become like him. So a true relationship with Jesus demands everything of us. And of course, this is yoga, this is self-realization, this is where the teachings really come together. And this is what Jesus taught in verses like, that which I do, ye shall do in greater things. And what could that possibly mean? Once you understand even a little bit of the teachings of self-realization, you realize what he's saying. What I have done, you shall do. This isn't me always separate from you. And Jesus at the end of his life saying to his disciples, you call me master, but I call you friend. He said a servant assists his master, but a servant never has any part of what his master's life is really about. But a friend, we share equally. And Jesus wasn't flattering his disciples, he was instructing them. He was saying, there's no limit to your consciousness. Your consciousness is the same as mine. You just haven't realized it yet. Where is the kingdom of heaven? The kingdom of heaven is within. So, the beginning of the oratorio and the beginning of our relationship to Jesus in the proper way, what I call the first part is the call to action. And there's two songs that we sing in relation to that. One is Children of God. Some of you are very familiar with the oratorio, so I'm just going to say the titles. Others, you'll see it when we start singing. Children of God, your time of trial is ended. Look to the light. And it's a thrilling anthem. And it's right where the oratorio begins. It's one of my favorite all-time songs ever. Because it just says, it's over. Delusion is over for you. Now you can come. You can be part of this new reality. And to sing that song as if you really believed it. And this is where singing them and not just listening to them, we're saying those words ourselves. We're making that declaration ourselves. We're feeling the unlimited potential. And it's a very dynamic piece of music. There's other pieces of music that take you very, very deep inside yourself, and they come later in the oratorio. But the first starting out, the actual first song is an instrumental called Setting Out for Zion, which is when we really put our feet on the path. But now this is God saying to us, children of God, you are children of God, awake. And the song that comes after that, Swami actually wrote for modern Israel, but it also has the same kind of a clarion call, a new tomorrow. When the dawn breaks, it's a new tomorrow. Those of us who have the courage, we can do it. I also like this because it gathers us all together. And in this, ultimately on the spiritual path, and as we get deeper into the oratorio, it becomes more singular. It really, and as Jesus' life increases in intensity, he calls each devotee and each devotee has to respond. But at the beginning, we can all set out together. Swamiji often talked about how Master called his work Self-Realization Fellowship. And Swami speaks of that really clearly because it was also a new clarification. Because self-realization is entirely uniquely individual. I, within myself, feel my relationship with God. I come to know who I am. And in a very real sense, to put fellowship on that is kind of almost a contradiction, isn't it? But in the time that we live, especially where the society is less than supportive of the ideals that we embrace, and in fact is on a mad dash in the opposite direction, how much materialism, how much self-indulgence, there's a real polarization of society. We really need each other. And we need each other to keep us strong, to clarify, to share experiences, to help each other, and also to give us the opportunity to expand our sympathies and not only selfishly think, what can I get for myself, but how can I help my brothers and sisters to find what I'm also seeking. So these two beginning songs really, put us in a group like that. And then, however, you don't really get far on the path of self-realization just relying on everyone else. In the early years of Ananda, when there was a huge back-to-the-land sort of hippie movement happening, and Swami said that a lot of the people who were going back to the land were American Indians who'd had the land taken away from them by the white people and were born rich enough to go buy it back for themselves. He's talked at different times about the reincarnated American Indians, who are a very strong force in our society at this time. in the 60s is when it really broke out, because people literally started going out into the country and living in teepees, and so did we. And this huge relationship to ecology and so on, he said that's a lot of American Indians coming back, trying to restore what's been destroyed. But also, in a positive and in a limiting way, that there was a certain tribal consciousness that came with that. And appropriately applied, it has power. Inappropriately applied, it imagines that somebody else can do it for me. That if I just get connected to this group, the group will work. And there was a lot of strange experiments about everybody moving together and so on like that. But true self-realization, sooner or later, has to be one's own determination that this is what I really want. And even if, I was thinking of another song of Swami's, Where Has My Love Gone? Strange how when love calls, memory stays calling across the tides of my days, of our days. And that what that verse means is even when we feel the call to God, even when we feel the call to God so strongly, the memory of all those other desires and attachments lingers, and it calls to us, and it just keeps trying to tell us, yes, of course, that's nice, but so is this, so is this, so is this. And the whole power of the spiritual path is to become so profoundly and deeply rooted in what you have to say, your own spine, which is the core. That's a physical way of saying, or it's actually referencing something non-physical. But you have to become so strong in the center of your own being that just like a tree with a very strong trunk, in our community we have many large and beautiful trees, and we have this exceedingly large elm which is right in the heart of the community. It's the grandfather tree for the whole place. And it has so many branches, but it's trunk and its roots are so strong that anything can happen all around it, and that trunk never wavers. And it that tree participates all the way out to the last leaf. It sends its life force all the way out to the last leaf, and those leaves can get, I see it out my window when it's raining and it's storming, those branches move, but that trunk never moves. And that's the tree of life we talk about. It's literally true with us. And so once we have answered that call, we have to also individually make that commitment. And so the second part that we sing is what we call the inner resolution. And it has the Psalm of David, the wonders that man, and in the spirit, I was called up in ecstasy. 'Twas a day sanctified by God. There he showed me the truths of heaven, truths which all seeking God must know. And it isn't yet our freedom, but it's the beginning of understanding in which direction our freedom lies. So these songs, by contrast to the first two, are very, very solitary, very inward songs. And there's just myself looking at God. The wonders that man did carve out of stone and wove out of music and called them his own did last but an hour, like Greece and like Rome. It was faith at last that did save them. I can't remember, the line escapes me at the moment, but we'll sing it in a moment. Yeah. Grace at last, when we called God our own. And just that one, I've sing that one to myself over and over again. The wonders that man did carve out of stone and wove out of music and called them his own. How long does it last? And that's the battle. It's not a simple battle. Somebody sent me a link to some, I don't have no idea even who the person was. It was a woman teaching from what they call the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, which is really just a couple of pages out of one of the Dead Sea Scrolls. At least this is what was. And it was beautiful, the gospel part. It was all about the chakras in the spine. But the woman commenting on it just said, you know, when you feel upset, go deeper until you're not upset. Oh, okay. Wow, I hadn't thought of that. I don't know, it's not enough merely to say, even within ourselves, you know, I want God, I want the divine search, I want to overcome my limitations. Those words are extremely easy to say. It's the many days and nights between that first hearing, children of God, to really repudiating all those memories. And not out of martyred self-sacrifice, but out of an actual experience that this is really what I'm seeking and this is not what I'm seeking. And that's where, whereas in the past, suffering and sorrow were the coin of man's redemption, for us now, this is from the Festival of Light, that payment has been exchanged for joy. You have to understand that properly, because it's not to say that we don't ever have our moments of tears and despair. But we understand that it's not the suffering that saves us. It's the realization that the only reason I suffer is because I'm holding on to something that is limited in its very nature and therefore will sooner or later disappoint me. And that my real avenue is to understand the joy of my own nature. But that takes the resolution. That's the battle. That's why all scriptures are war of some kind. The life of Jesus is him against the wrong teaching. But many scriptures are the Bhagavad Gita. It's an actual physical battlefield. And the reason for that is because that's what it feels like. And so we have to go deep in our spine, which these songs do. Then the next part is all about Mary, and it's all about the divine mother aspect of God. And the fact that Mary is in a female body is not what makes her the divine mother. What makes her the divine mother is that she embodies compassion and total acceptance. And it is the story of the incarnation of Jesus, because Mary was such a partner to Jesus in this. But it's also an essential relationship that we have to establish, because you know, this is a battle, and we are being asked to let go of many things just a little ahead of the time before we are embracing something new. And it's just that sort of, we almost know what we want, and we almost know what we don't want, but it's a very tenuous. And what saves us in that moment is feeling the unconditional love and support of the divine. And this is why the feminine aspect of God, Jesus called it the Comforter. And that's just, and when he was speaking of the Comforter, those were his words for the Divine Mother, for the Om. Because when you are supported by the Comforter, and that's what Jesus told his disciples, I'm leaving now, but I will send you the Comforter. And the Comforter is that inner understanding of the compassion of God. And so we tune ourselves by singing about Mary. And through Mary, you know, in the traditional Catholicism, you appeal to Mary and then Mary intercedes for you with Jesus, which I've always thought was so dear, because what it's really saying is the mother is more approachable. And Master said that too. Master said, pray to God as mother. He can't resist you when you do that. Because the He is the power beyond creation. The she is the power within creation, and when we and the she is close to us, just like, and the master says, the mother is closer than the father, is how he puts it. If you think of human life, that's what you see. When the child falls and is injured, the mother is the one who holds you. So on our own spiritual path, recognizing and trusting that aspect of God is really essential to give us the courage and the strength to go on. I don't think anybody can make it without the Comforter. And that's why Jesus, as he's dying, that's what he says to his disciples. I'm going away, but I will send you the Comforter. And the Comforter will tell you things that I myself can't tell you. Because the Comforter being inside of you, you will open. You will open. And then that different vibration will come to you. It's so sweet. So when we sing all these mother songs, feel it not just as devotion to Mary, but feel it as a deep acceptance within our own selves of God's unconditional love for us. Somebody asked me recently, considering how early in my life I started on the path and how much of my life has passed, she asked me to tell her three things that I've learned. It was an interesting question. Just because you might be curious, I'll just answer it. I was very judgmental of people, and I'm not now. I can still be impatient, but I'm not judgmental as I was. I didn't used to have that much sympathy, but I have a great deal of sympathy for everybody's suffering. Now you suffer enough yourself, and you get really sympathetic with other people's suffering. But, and the third thing I said was that I know that God loves me. And I actually have been thinking about that as to whether or not I actually do or not. And I had to decide that I think I overstated it. I believe that God loves me. I'm not sure that I know. Because I still have some anxiety inside of myself. And if I really knew that God loves me, I would be completely at peace. I believe he loves me, though. I believe she loves me. And that's what we're looking for. But think about that. It was a very interesting meditation. If I really did know that, why would I ever feel inadequate, insecure, nervous? Why? Because you would have the one thing that really matters in every respect. So that's why Mary is there. And the way Mary loved Jesus, the way Mary surrendered to God, just the mere feminine vibration, not woman, but feminine, which is unconditionally accepting, receiving, always present, comforting. That's what we're looking for. So, let's begin. So we'll start and we'll just sing through without stopping, then we'll meditate. I think it's better if people stand because I think we sing more dynamically. We can also kind of crowd together, as I'm always suggesting. We're going to turn off the film and the recording and everything like that. It's just... I hope you all enjoy this as much as I do. that very last line of the very last song we sang, blessed is the fruit of thy womb, and then you just say that name, Jesus, with that music. After all these centuries, they're so, just that very name has so much evocative power. You know, just to just say it out like that, just the whole... A whole universe opens up behind it. There is the cosmic reality of universalizing these masters of self-realization. And in our Festival of Light, which is a ritual for Dwapara Yuga, in which Swami draws pieces from many different places. When we gave it once here on a Sunday, afterwards a person accosted me, and there's a line in there, God's chosen people have always been those of every race or nation who with deep love chose him, chose thee. And the person was Jewish, and if you're steeped in Judaism at all, the concept of who is chosen and who is not looms very large in the vocabulary of that teaching. So to dispute it was annoying. And so the individual was very emphatic with me about how insulted he felt by that. And by divine grace, this thought came to me. Oh, I said, Swami's insulting the Hindus and the Christians too. You're just not educated enough to know where all those references were. Because it was true. Insult is not really the right word, but since that's where he was taking it, that's what I was saying. Which is to say, dismantling the only begotten, the Christ consciousness. You know, it's a wholly different. And whereas suffering and sorrow in the past, I mean, that's a complete affront to a great many parts of it. Here then is the fourth and last stage of the soul's long journey. He's dismantling in an elegant manner all of these different ossified traditions. Not because there isn't truth behind them, but the truth behind it has become ossified through Kali Yuga. And it's a whole new age right now. And at the same time, there is something so profoundly, there's so many things that are traditional that are also profoundly true. And the art, the science of self-realization are the principles, and the art of it is to be in tune enough with your own heart to be able to know what is really going to inspire you. And everybody's different. Again, someone asked me once, it's just odd questions people ask that sometimes are very thought-provoking. And the question was, what of the eight aspects of God, what are you most attracted to? It was a personal question. And it was an interesting question. And I thought for a moment, I said joy, and then I said wisdom. And I'm not a jnana yogi, in the sense that the essence of jnana is to always be repudiating the apparent reality of this world and seeking through power to find the truth behind it. I was saying to a jnanic friend of mine, well, not jnanic, he isn't really, he's more of a Vedantist, to be fair, just to be fair to him. I said, I really don't think this world is a dream like very often every day. He laughed and he said, oh, I think about it absolutely constantly. It's just like that's how he holds himself on the path, is he's always reminding himself that this is an illusion. I just forget and go play in the illusion and try to get myself out of it in another way. But the wisdom aspect of the spiritual path, in another way of saying that, is a passion for truth. Just always really wanting to understand what the truth is behind something. But merely wanting the truth, the truth behind something, doesn't mean that the sweetness of the lila of the divine play is any less sweet. So even though we can talk about Jesus as the Christ consciousness, and at one point Swamiji, in an attempt to make the festival more acceptable in India, where many people are still deeply scarred by the advent of the missionaries and have to work hard to respect Jesus because of the way he was used as a weapon against their own culture. Swami added into the festival here and there infinite consciousness, Christ consciousness, just a line here and there. But still, the personal relationship with Jesus, as the individual who came, don't turn away from it if your heart wants it. Don't let your philosophy or your wisdom confuse your heart. Your heart knows well. I remember I was talking to Swamiji once about the life of Jesus, and Swami had written, it may have been something he'd written, and he called the life story of Jesus the greatest story ever told, which is how it's often referred to. And I was, you know, I was a little flippant a lot of times in my life. And I sort of, just as in an editorial way, said, really, Swami, the greatest story ever told? And I'll never forget, his eyes got really wide. And he looked like he was about 7 years old. He said, don't you think it is? Just like that. And it just, it gave me this whole other understanding how all of these things exist at the same time. That's why Jesus himself said, Be ye therefore like little children, for of such is the kingdom of God. And he didn't mean by that we lose track of the wisdom of God. But it's almost like the more we have of the wisdom, the more simple our devotion becomes, because we understand that all of this, we don't have to pretend to be wise. And we don't have to be, as I've said recently about Americans, who being shrewd is really the the bane of our country. It's our greatness because we are shrewd, and we know how to make things work. We're very practical and not that sentimental at times. But that shrewdness can really work against you spiritually, you know. And I felt it so sweetly, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus, just that word, and how all that evokes. And Easter time, somehow even more than Christmas, because everything about it is so magnificent, and we're not burdened with all the social chaos that comes with Christmas. We do a very good job, I think, of holding it. But still, to receive him is to understand the greatness and then become like a little child in the face of it. Many of you have heard the story of Hare Krishna Ghosh, who was the son of Sananda Ghosh, Sananda Ghosh being Master's brother. When we started going to India in 1986, Hare Krishna was still living, and for the 20 years or so that we went to India, he died toward the end of that, or perhaps after that. His wife died, and then he died. And he had a sister who was younger than he, and Hare Krishna was elderly. He was 15 years old in 1935 when Master came to Calcutta, the one trip he took to back to India from America. And Hare Krishna was 15, and he had a lot of time with Master during that, and he would tell us those stories. But his sister, Shefli, was 3. And Shefli felt herself her whole life to be a disciple of Master's, but her only physical contact with him was when she was 3. And a few years after we started going, in India they would reveal themselves to us slowly. Americans just put everything on the table in the first meeting, but they would sort of, we didn't even know he had a sister, and it took us a long time. And finally Shefli came, and she didn't speak English. She whispered her story in Bengali, and then Hare Krishna would tell to us in English. But she doesn't even remember this, but this is how it's told to her. She had an instant and absolute total affection for Master from the moment she saw him. And she had a 3-year-old's total lack of inhibition. She loved him. It was clear that he loved her. Therefore, she belonged to him. And whenever he was in the house, she was going to be on his lap or by his side. And there was no discussion. This is just the way it was. And Master responded to her in exactly the same way. And every time I think about devotion, I think, be ye therefore as little children. Shefli was a very refined and sophisticated woman, and lived a very refined life. And as all of us, as she grew older, she grew more inhibited. She was very shy even to tell her story. But she was much wiser when she was 3. And the one little story that's told, I think it might be in Sananda's book, was that when they were going to go off to the movies, and Shefli was too young to be allowed to go, but she refused to be separated from Master. And Master, Indian children are often quite delicate, and Shefli was delicate even as an adult, so even when she was 3, she must have been very tiny. He put her on his chest, he buttoned his coat over her, and she just went to the movies with him and spent the whole time with just resting against his heart. I mean, think of that just even as a meditation, to be picked up by the Master, bundled up in his coat, and then just put your head against his heart and stay there. You see, the power of it all is that omnipresence, he allows every one of us. Every one of us has that unique individual relationship. So when we celebrate, which is what we do next, the coming of Jesus, I mean, it's not possible to overstate the importance of this. And also, as we say later, and it comes more in the last part of it where it's so much more poignant, when we need you, you descend. And we do it, it's in the Festival of Light. A prayer of love went up from earth and you responded. And that you has a capital Y on it when you're reading it, but it's also very direct. You responded. A ray of your light flashed out from infinity, burst downward through night skies of consciousness, and was born on earth for the redemption of mankind. And then that actual last phrase, in human form. And that prayer is our prayer. And Jesus was born. Yogananda, Sri Yukteswar, Lahiri, Babaji, they were born because of your need, because of my need. It's so amazing to contemplate. Swamiji says in another place when he talks about the new dispensation of Master, that's the little pamphlet. He says, when enough people pray strongly enough, that's how he puts it, when enough people pray strongly enough, then the divine must respond. Because you see, this is a love relationship. If you raise children, if you teach children, if you have any relationship to them, you know they can insist. And there's that even that story about Shefley. Shefley would not be left at home. And they just had no choice. Master tells stories of he wanted a certain candy and the candy maker shop was closed and he absolutely refused to give up and they had to wake up the candy maker to get him that candy. Sri Yukteswar says he developed an affection for a certain dog and he wanted that dog as a pet. And no other dog would do. It had to be that dog. And all of these are the Leela demonstration of that other desire. A prayer of love went up from earth and you responded. And the prayer is really simple. It's what I call the piglet prayer from the Winnie the Pooh, the wisdom of Winnie the Pooh. There's one little story in which Pooh and Piglet are, they go off expotition. That's what they call them. They go off on an expotition. And they aren't very far away, but the fog comes in, and so they are completely lost, and they just don't know where they are. And they're trying to solve the problem in various ways. And Piglet just gives into despair and just sort of falls, collapses like this. And then with the last bit of his strength, he raises his head, and he says, "Help, help, help," like this. And then he collapses again. And because they're not actually any distance from home, you know, his cry is heard and they're rescued. But I always think that's just the best possible prayer there is. We're just out there in the fog. And we just don't know where we are. And we just collapse. And we just, with our last bit of strength, a prayer of love went up from earth and you responded. Swami made it so elegant, but it's all it is. And somewhere later on, there's the line, Jesus descending, seeking grieving hearts to mend. We sang that on Sunday, and I just heard that line. Jesus came into the earth seeking grieving hearts so that he could mend. You know, we tend to think that our brokenness separates us from God, because all the ways in which we're broken make it so difficult for us to do our sadhana correctly and do as many kriyas as we should and practice all the higher kriyas every day and remember to do our affirmations and to gaze into the sun when the sun is rising and setting. My friend Jamal, who is the only one among us who's ever done this so far, he took a whole year of seclusion. He went down to the desert and he spent a whole year. And he said he was never in a hurry. And he was able to, he said, to do all the things that Master said. He would read about some little technique and he could actually had all the time in the world to go out and practice it. And it's very rare to be able, in the American world, to be able to just have that much time. We're too busy serving. Our sadhana is karma yoga is a huge part of what we're doing, so I'm not saying one way or another, but just an interesting comment. He was actually able to practice every technique because he had nothing else to do and he had the temperament to do it. But the way in which we are broken, either restless or afraid, or when it gets too quiet, there's too much in there that we really don't want to be with, so we have to get up and go do something else, or we've just pushed it as far as we can push it. The way we're broken, we think, is what keeps us from being closer to God. But when I heard that line, and of course Swami's fitting poetry to melody, but he always told the truth. Seeking grieving hearts to mend. You know, in a spiritual path like ours, I know some people join particular churches in this area. I don't know if they still do, but 30 years ago when churches were more important, people still did. And there were certain ones that people joined because they were interested in advancing their lives, and the people who could help them advance their lives were part of those churches. You know, there's a lot of wealthy, influential people in this area, and if you join the church that they belong to, then you might get to know them in a different way, and that could be beneficial. I'm not saying it's entirely hypocritical, but people have chosen that. What I love about our church is that nobody would come here for that reason. You only come here if it's really, really, really working for you in the world. It doesn't occur to you that you need to transcend it. You know, you're still on that side of it. You're still swimming out. You haven't yet turned around and started trying to come back in yet. And it's fine. It's just a different stage of life. And, you know, many highly successful people, especially in this area, are doing really, really good work for the advancement of the planet. So there's no judgment here. But Jesus comes and he's looking for the broken hearts. Why? Because the broken hearts are open to all who received him. They're open. They're ready to say, there's got to be an answer here. So just think how our souls rejoice. And that's what the first songs we sing. Jesus comes, you know, and it's bells and music and everybody's so excited. Sing out with joy. He's here. Because think what that really means. We wrote a verse. I wonder if I can remember it. Let me just think for a minute. We wrote a song for Swamiji's birthday 1 year. And unfortunately, the exact words of it escape me at the moment. But part of the little saga was Swamiji saying yes to Master. And all of us being so happy over here because he'd done that, because we knew what that meant for us. How the cycle goes. You know, we're all in this wire together. So when the Master hears the call, then we all rejoice. And it's the most unconditioned enthusiasm we should have for anything. That's why we celebrate Master's birthday. That's why we celebrate Christmas. It's a tradition in Indian ashrams that you don't celebrate any birthday except the Guru's birthday. I mean, not that we've never been so rigid about those things, but that's a birthday worth celebrating. Swami Kriyananda's birthday is a birthday worth celebrating. Jesus' birthday is a birthday worth celebrating, because he's looking for my broken heart. Your love alone can mend. That's another line we have. When we need you, you descend. Our human griefs, your love alone can mend. And then it goes on to say, by proud indifference unaffected, though eternally rejected, meaning people are not paying attention to God, you are undeterred by that. You remain our friend no matter what we do. And then the first part is Jesus coming, and then the second part we sing is, it's now that our call has been heard, we've put ourselves forward, we've met the Comforter, now it's time for serious sadhana. And then we sing the songs like Desert Solitude, and Jesus himself going off into the desert, the temptation of Christ, just all the different ways. There's these multiple stages. And in the first part, we went through it the same way, the clarion call. Then we have to become more serious about that. Then the preparation for the birth of the Messiah, the preparation for the birth within us. And then the joy of Jesus is coming, but oh, merely because he's here, still much is required. And Jesus didn't have to do sadhana himself, but of course he went off to the desert. He went off to India, but that's not in the oratorio. And he himself did the sadhana, and then that's what we have to do. Those four songs are some of the most beautiful because now we're beginning to understand what we've gotten ourselves into. I remember about 8 or 9 years into the spiritual path when I was still living in the monastery with the other women, we used to, I think hollow, mirthless laugh was the phrase. We got that from P.G. Woodhouse. Because it looks easier when you start than it turns out to be when you're in the middle. And the way we characterize it to ourselves, you see the island out there and you just dive in the water and you start swimming. And in the way of these things, it's a little farther away than you thought it was. And so, and you've sprinted at the beginning and then you're sort of out of breath and you're too far from shore and you're not on the island yet. You can't really go back and you don't really want to. But you don't have quite as much strength for the long run. And you sort of, you sort of tread water and consider your options. See if there's any real choice in the matter. Someone said something to someone about, oh, well, you know, you've passed through that challenge pretty well. It looks like, you know, you're moving through it now. And the response was a real serious response. What choice did I have? What choice did I have? And a lot of times, what passes for courage is not courage at all. Oh, well, it is courage. It's truth. What choice do I have? That's the sitting there halfway to the island and too far from shore and treading water and considering your options. And that's where sadhana comes in. That's where the devil tempts you. That's where you isolate yourself. That's where you try to strengthen yourself. Not because you have it all together, but what choice do you have? The only way through it, you see what's in front of you, and you can't dive back into something that you already know to be transparent, even if where you're going may still just be a theory. You know, it's not like it's all desert, as Swami says. It's not like it's totally desert and then suddenly it's all green. It's like the terrain changes slowly. And you have many positive things. When Jaya was asked in India if he had cosmic consciousness, because they always want to know who's teaching them, and they want to know if you have samadhi, which you don't, and so you're sort of in trouble. At the same time, you know you have a lot to tell them. So you have to balance the point between being truthful. Of course, you're going to be truthful, but you also want to keep your position because Swami has taught us a lot that a lot of people don't know. And they really need to hear it from you. That's impersonal. So Jaya's answer, he thought about it for a moment, and he said, I have the ability to choose happiness. And he then even said, apparently, I don't always choose it, he said, but I do have that. In other words, it's not all black or white, but sadhana is really important to it. And these sadhana songs in this, the time for spiritual practice, this is my son, walk where he leads, and the power of Satan tempting you. It's very, very serious. And it has I think the word I want to use, it has a purity to it, because everything just comes down to God chooses those who choose him. And every week in that Festival of Light, with all my heart, with all my mind, with all my soul, with all my strength, I choose thy love. And we, if you say that, as we say it, with all that energy, gaze upon this light as a symbol of God's love, and then we say that together, publicly, it goes way, way deep inside of you. So when Satan tempts you, you can just say, get thee behind me. It's not necessarily that you're holding the bliss in your hand, but what choice do I have? And that Swamiji said, when he was asked once, what is the secret of success on the spiritual path? One of the things he said was, when you realize it's a matter of life or death. Just that, what choice do I have? the alternative, this might not be as much fun as I hoped it would be, or this might not be the funnest year I've ever been through. When we were in the middle of the litigation, which went on for a decade, I remember thinking, I'm glad I've had other experiences besides this one. You know, this is not the funnest period I've ever been through, but what choice do I have? The more deeply you can say that, the more powerful you get. And then after Jesus is tempted by Satan and puts Satan aside, then he comes out and, as we call it, the ministry begins. Jesus went to Galilee, the few were soon many, the multitude came. And you just have this thrilling vicarious experience and on two levels. One is rejoicing that Jesus is doing it, and the other is thinking about being there and meeting him. I love to just make the story real. I guess because I lived with Swamiji for so long, and I saw how completely natural even a very great soul is, that there's nothing fake or Cecil B. DeMille about it. You know, some of the movies, there's some movie about Jesus in which he turns the water into wine, and you see him straining with every ounce of his physical body, straining to turn the water into wine, and then collapsing in a perspiring heap when he's finally managed to do it. You know, it's just, that's not it. Or else every statement is, I remember some novel about the life of Jesus, and every 15 minutes they were all going to the ritual baths and changing into new white clothes and then going to the temple to decide what the menu would be for lunch or something like that. I kept thinking, who did all the laundry? You know, they were always changing into new white clothes. Who was doing all the laundry? It was not real. When I lived with Swami all the time, and all of you saw him too, he was just so perfectly at ease. And he told us that was what Master was like. You might think, well, Master was different. He said, no, Master was perfectly at ease, just perfectly natural. Oh, that one needs a cup of tea. Could you get him some tea over here? Is there a chair? That looks good. Oh, you know, did you see the building that was going up over here? And we went out for a drive and the car was nice. And simultaneously, always just exuding this divine energy. So when you think of Jesus coming to Galilee and being a young man and this being such an adventure, and if that part of the history is true, that they were all Essenes together, they were in this community, they knew what was coming, they understood the importance of his mission, not different than us. I mean, we don't sit around telling ourselves how important what we're doing is, but we believe in what we're doing. We know that Master's coming was a change for the whole planet, and Swami's part in it, and our part in Swami's life. We know that it's something thrilling from the point of view of having a meaningful life. You know, so many people's lives are just like riding on water. It's just gone. And as individuals, it'll be gone. But what we're part of and what we're helping to establish will endure for a long time. And you know those disciples of Jesus, they knew who he was, they knew why he'd come, and they knew how honored they were to be part of it. And at the same time, really, they were just like us. And I love to think about all these stories and all these songs and all these situations as they really happened. And we know how they really happened because we're living the same story. We really are. We're living just the same story. Except it was a different time, a different place, but it was exactly the same story, which is just one more way that we can become childlike. We don't have to be intimidated. This is our own. Jesus is our own. And he's been glorified and a lot of mythology around him. But way back in its essence, we're Shefli at the age of 3. Suffer little children to come unto me. I mean, the scene there, which that was spoken, was he was in a crowd. He was always in a crowd. And mothers were bringing their babies to be blessed, which if you've ever been with Swami in India, but what mothers above all want to do is stick their babies in front of the saint and have the saint bless him because they have a great belief in it. Mothers were bringing their babies. The children were intrigued. And it was causing a lot of chaos in those among those who were, and perhaps even with good intention, trying to keep things in order, we're trying to shoo the children away. And Jesus corrected them, "Suffer little children to come unto me, for of such is the kingdom of heaven." But how real and natural that scene would be. Can you see it? Swamiji sitting here talking to us, and some of the school children breaking in, and as children are, without any inhibition, just kind of climbing up into the middle of it, interrupting. But he wanted them to understand these are the ones, because they trust their heart. And that's what we have to do in this. So let's now sing this next part. Jesus comes, spiritual practice, and his ministry. Because when he first wrote this, he just had us all singing it all the time. And he never thought of his music as performance. He always thought of it as sadhana. So every so often one comes up with an idea that he really likes. And so you always treasure that. But this was an idea he really, really, really liked. And he was hoping that over time it would just become like the way that people sing the Messiah, of course. But just that would really just become part of what we do. You know, my explanation of it is extra. It's really the singing of it that he wanted. So mark your chakras with that, so that when you have the opportunities in other parts of the world to bring it into place, remember, for obvious reasons, when you start really singing it, how many times have we heard this? I've heard it so many times, I don't even have to have the words in front of me for the most part. But every time you just start hearing parts in it about, and the melodies are so fantastic. What was it? There was a line here that I really heard. The whole temptation with Satan singing, and Satan sounds so reasonable you don't even actually realize it's Satan. Yeah, you have to actually know that it's Satan singing. He just says dominion now over all this noble earth. Like, what's the problem with that? But behold all the wonders God's grace can bestow if you but reclaim what you've given. That's a very subtle line. And there's Jesus, he's given his whole life to God to do God's will. And then he says, well, now, this is the thought that comes in. If I just had more worldly power, I could do more good. And that's where religions try to become wealthy. That's where they try to get celebrities to endorse them. That's where they try to become political. If I just had more power in this world, then I could do more good for God. And that's the whole story of Judas, which is what we're coming into now, as Master explains it, that Judas believed in Jesus. And that's why he was able to be liberated, in this era, which is what Master said. It's not that he lost faith in Jesus. He just thought he knew better than Jesus did about how to get the message across. Swami writes about that in his chapter in the Path called Attunement, which is also a very subtle chapter. And he talks about how it's so easy for the thought to come into the devotee's mind. And he was speaking especially when you were living with Master. And he did things in ways that didn't make sense to you. It was easy to think, well, he's really advanced spiritually, but this I understand better than him. And Swami talked about how dangerous that is for the devotee. I remember when Swamiji first wrote the commentaries for the Bible and the Bhagavad Gita, the first version of that, which still exists somewhere, there's like three versions, I think, or two, maybe two or three. But the first version was there was a Bible commentary, then a Gita commentary, and they had to be read on Sundays. And each was longer than the total of what we read now. And some of them were immensely long. And our habit here was to have many people in the congregation read, which is a very good thing to do. Some of them read better than others. And some of those readings were really long for someone who didn't read really well. Some of them were really long for anybody to read, just because it was a lot to be read. And I chafed under that more than was necessary. But nonetheless, they just, I may be less judgmental now, but I was really impatient. I'm still impatient, and I was really impatient. I just had such a hard time with that. And I was always trying to find a way out of it. And I wasn't the only one. I just was the biggest voice. And I remember that this was must have been our first year living here because of the house we were in, and Swami was there with a whole group of people. He used to come with a lot of the leaders from the village. And we had this long, extremely intense discussion about it, at the end of which he announced that Asha didn't have to have them. She didn't have to use them. If she didn't, you know, she could speak well enough. She didn't have to have those readings. If she didn't want to use them, she didn't have to use them. She could excerpt from them. He announced this, or she could excerpt from them or just not use them at all. And, you know, I'd been vindicated. I got what I wanted. There was a certain protest that, well, if Asha doesn't have to do them, then a lot of other people are not going to want to have to do them. Swami said, no, they have to do them, but she doesn't. Well, I mean, I had what I wanted. Later in the day, the next morning, I'm not quite sure when it was. I mean, there was something smelly about this solution, I could tell. And I was in the kitchen of that house, and we had a trash can that you stepped on, and the lid came up, and I had a plate in my hand, and it had the remnants of some dinner. I mean, it was all very vivid. And I stepped on it and opened it up, and I was about to scrape the plate in it, and this thought came as just absolutely as clear as if it had been spoken in front of me. If you agree to this, you will get so out of tune, you will leave the path. And so I scraped off the plate, I slammed the trash can, and it was sort of like, I'm not going to do it. And I went back and I said, no, Swamiji, I'm going to read them just like everyone else. He made no comment at all. But I knew it. It was like you set yourself in rebellion. And he knew, I mean, Swami knew as much as anyone, you know, what the pros and the cons of that were. He was going on a long trajectory, and I was going to pull my little part out of it. And, you know, sometimes God thwarts you, and sometimes he says, okay, just go ahead, see what happens. So you that's why you can't always tell what God's will is on the basis of whether it goes easily or not. Because you don't actually know which one it is. There it was, Swami himself gave me exactly what I wanted. But it was smelly. I could feel it. He was just pushing me to see which way I broke on it. And thank you, God, I broke in the right direction. And, you know, we just lived with them. But I'm not going to put myself in the same category as Judas. But it's just that little bit of a thought that everything is fine except this little thing, and I'll just fix that, and then everything will really be fine. And it's a fine line because your creativity is required. Swamiji always wanted me to express myself. I said, sir, sometimes I'm too emotional. He said, doesn't matter. You should say it anyway. I said, sometimes I fly off the handle. He said, sometimes you should fly off the handle. I mean, he never let me out of it merely by saying, I'm going to wait till my attitude is right. Because he knew I'd have to wait too long. Because if you merely suppress it, that's not the same as transcending it. So it was better to just have it be out there so it could be worked with. So, I mean, nobody liked those long readings, but I was the only one who fought the battle. And in the end, just most of you know the story, he wrote the Rubaiyat, the commentary on the Rubaiyat, which was so beautiful that we came up with this idea that we would use that as our reading. And so we used it as our reading. And we were just in this church, and Dharmini lived here then, and she played a beautiful flute. And just because of the acoustics, she would stand in the bell tower, and she would play the melody of it, and Chaitanya would sing the verse from the balcony. And then we'd read it. I mean, it was gorgeous. It was really gorgeous. So we did it for a whole year. And then it was so lovely, we asked to do it for a second year. And then the second year was over, and we were going to have to come back to those long readings. And I was no more reconciled to them, really. I mean, I'd accepted them, but I didn't like them anymore. So I wrote Swamiji a letter. And Swami always, we didn't have email then. Fax was the way he was in Europe. And he forever after referred to the tear-stained fax he received from Asha. Of course, there's no physical way you can cry on the fax he actually receives. But he called it the tear-stained fax from Asha, pleading with me not to force her to go. It was all very personal. Force her to go back to those readings. He announces this to the whole world. And so he started writing the ones we use now. At which point I get all this secret support from the other side. Hooray, hooray, you did it. You know, I was the sacrificial lamb. But I learned a lot, of course. I'd rather read those readings for the rest of my life than risk it. So you have to, path is a very, very, very fine line. And Satan, I mean, you can't even really tell if it's Satan if you just read the words. You have to know the context and who the me is and what it is that you're taking back. So we come into the last part of the life of Jesus. You know where all of that comes into play. Swamiji talks about the karma of the life of Jesus, speaking of how mangled the teachings have become of Jesus. And, you know, even now they've been politicized to the point. When Swami wrote the oratorio and he'd had this hope that he could inspire a renaissance in the churches toward inner communion instead of merely outer communion. And I remember him saying to us, we mustn't let them take away from us the word Christian. He said the word Christian has become to mean something, and it also has become politicized. And he said it's not right. We can't let them take it away from us. He said we have to have the strength to define what it means to be a follower of Jesus and not have it become increasingly what it's become. You know, the whole religion is not well respected right now. Swami writes about this in another context. Decades ago he wrote this. He said religion no longer commands the respect it used to. The job of being a clergyman, you know, the clergy person, the pastor in the community used to be a person of great respect and influence, but not at all. I mean, and there was a time in my own life when no one would have a school event or a sporting event on Sunday morning. It just was unthinkable. And now everybody does. I mean, that's when the children go out and play soccer, is they go out and play soccer on Sunday morning, and no one even thinks it odd. Because religion just doesn't have that respect. The YMCA, Young Men's Christian Association, is open from 9 to 1 on Easter morning. I mean, just out of the question decades ago. But now no one even flinches. And all to the good. Because that institutionalized, I'll join this church because then I can network and it'll help my business. Or even worse, where, you know, the Supreme Court decisions, the legislation, the who gets elected is all on this rigid, what do you believe sort of energy. And then we're astonished when the other people from other equally rigid things want to attack and obliterate us. And I referenced earlier the difficulty, you know, self-realization has in India with Jesus on the altar because the missionaries did not win the hearts of the people in India because they had such scorn for their much older, much more subtle teaching. So for all of us now, we have this, and this is our responsibility. And you see, this is exactly what Jesus was doing. Jesus was born to the remnant of true Judaism, which was the Essene tradition. They were the ones who'd held it. And it was, you know, Kali Yuga marching downward. And what was called Judaism was actually a corrupt priesthood. When I was in Jerusalem a year and a half ago, we were walking toward where the big temple had stood, and we had a historical guide who was very interesting, telling us lots of things. And he was explaining to us that this neighborhood, which of course is now modern built, all the archaeological showed that it was the extremely wealthy, extremely luxurious, and it was where all the priests and temple officials lived. right next to the temple. But it was Scarsdale. It was Atherton. It was wealth and power and money, and that was Judaism, because they had gotten control of it and were squeezing the life out of it. And then there were the Essenes, and Jesus was born into the Essenes, and the Essenes were still following Sanatana Dharma. They were, because Judaism is a true and glorious religion, and they were still following it. And that was the confrontation. And Jesus and his followers knew exactly what they were doing, but this powerful force was going to hold on to, and people never give up power once they have it. They just don't. They just hold it. And they had the power to, they believed, to crush him out, but all they did was kill his body. Because it was impossible for them to obliterate the truth. He personified it. He did not define it. And even as he came in on Palm Sunday into Jerusalem, and the story of Palm Sunday, when you think about it, it's very interesting, because Jesus was this underground movement, and the Essenes were almost a secret society. Were a secret society to a very large extent, because the Pharisees and those with the power, they didn't want the Essenes around. And so they were underground. And all the power seemed to be in that huge temple with all that authority that they had gradually gathered over many, many centuries. But the real power was in the truth. And not the truth of the word of God, but the simple truth, the kingdom of God is within you. All those who receive him will become the sons of God. That which I do, ye shall do in greater things. The few were soon many, and all that they asked was just to live in God and to be joyful. And when you, in my one little journey, when I saw the temple in Jerusalem and then the Sea of Galilee, and the Sea of Galilee is still quite undeveloped. So it's really just open, and it's like that's where Jesus really had his people. But he knew that he had to dramatically demonstrate the contrast between the power of God that was in him and the power of the world that everyone was so enamored of and frightened of. In that little bit that we read on last night about Peter, and now Jesus is taken away to the high priest's house and he's imprisoned there, and then someone comes and identifies Peter and sneaks him in. But he was being snuck in, because the disciples of Jesus would not have been welcome in that house. And it was also very dangerous for him to be there, because they didn't know what was going to happen. Were they going to wipe out everyone? Because they'd been threatening to do it all along. So that's why Jesus, when he was asked three times if he was with Jesus, he said, no, I'm not. Because he was afraid. Just as simple as that. So what Jesus was doing, standing up to that power, was not just dinner table conversation. It was all the power was there, and they somehow had enough consciousness left to perceive the threat that Jesus was. They didn't, if they were, Pontius Pilate didn't even know he was a threat. The worldly people didn't even know he was a threat. But those who had taken their power in the name of religion falsely knew that he was a threat. And that's why they had to work so hard, because they could see him just gathering followers and gathering energy and really coming forward. I don't want to draw too sharp a point on it, but it was the same thing that happened with SRF and Ananda, which is that SRF rightly understands that Ananda is a terrible threat, because they are exclusive institutional authority. Their claim is that the only way that the blessings of the masters can pass is through this one channel. And it works as long as they're the only channel. As long as they had a monopoly, it was fine. But when this other completely unauthorized and declared to be heretical channel begins to have power, it's a tremendous threat to the entire basis for what they're doing. Of course, it's all imaginary, but not imaginary in the way they're playing it out. And so here we go again. But that's where Jesus was. And Judas was confused. Why are you always causing so much trouble with these people? They could be our best supporters. They have all that real estate. They have all that money. They have all the respect, all we need. Let's just, you know, we can work it out. We can play both sides a little. And the way Master writes it, Judas thought that if he pushed Jesus into a corner, that Jesus would declare himself with power. So Judas did not expect that Jesus would surrender and allow himself to be killed. He thought that when pushed to it, Jesus would show who he really was. And that's why immediately after Judas killed himself, because it had just gone so horribly wrong. If he really didn't believe in Jesus, it would have just, well, yeah, look at that. But it was just the opposite. Very subtle. He'd listened to the voice of Satan. He'd started worshiping me, meaning Satan. He was trying to get dominion over this world. So the life of Jesus is just this, especially this part of the story. It's just such a stark and challenging choice. It is and it isn't. What do I really believe in? But we have to take seriously the fact that three times Peter said he wasn't even a follower of Jesus. You know, we can't be glib about the courage. But of course, then when Jesus was resurrected, that changed everything. But then Jesus came to Peter three times. He said to Peter, "Do you love me?" And Peter said, "Yes." And then he asked him again, "Do you love me?" Peter said, "Yes." "Why do you keep asking me?" He asked him a third time. Peter said, "Yes." And of course, it's so beautiful. You know, three times he said yes, when three times he'd said no. Because Jesus comes to the brokenhearted. And he doesn't come to those who already have achieved God realization. They don't need him. It's we who need him. And the poignancy, it's just, as Swami said, isn't it such a great story? The poignancy, which is so much in the songs we're about to sing. You know, you just feel all that promise, all that longing. Blessed are they, he who closed the fields to souls that were fallen. You know, living water, all of this tremendous expectation. And then, who dreamed of the tragedy that was about to happen? And then he does die. You know, what did they expect? They didn't know. They didn't know he would be taken. They didn't know he would allow himself to be taken. They didn't know he would be crucified. I mean, all of it was being acted out for the first time. That's sort of what, at least I feel in this music. It's all being acted out for the first time. You don't know the end of this story. And you have so much faith in this man. And then you just watch himself completely allow himself to be dominated by fools and knaves. You know, why? And then you have those days where there it is. It's just over. And Mary Magdalene, being a childlike devotee, you know, as soon as it was light and she was able, the Sabbath was over and she was able, she rushes back to the tomb and she's the first to see that the tomb is empty. It's just like, and her thought is they've stolen his body. I mean, the first thought is not, oh, he's been resurrected and he's dematerialized, and it's just, they've stolen him. You know, these horrible people who've done so many terrible things, now they've stolen his body. I can't even properly prepare it and honor it and bury it because they've stolen it. And then, of course, she realizes that he's transcended completely differently. Just think of that. She rushes to the tomb. She's utterly distraught because it's gone. She turns out, she speaks, and I love the way they tell it. She thinks he's the gardener. He just puts a veil over her face, and she thinks he's the gardener. Where have they taken him? And then he says her name. And she comes out of it and realizes. And what's so beautiful about Mary is, she doesn't doubt for a second. As soon as he identifies himself, she knows everything that's happened. And so she rushes back to tell the others, who are a little more skeptical, understandably. You know, Mary's overwrought. Is this a hysterical vision on her part? And then for 40 days, that's what you have to also understand. He didn't just show up once. He came when they were locked in the room for fear of being arrested and crucified themselves. And Jesus, there he was in the midst of them. Just, you know, every up and down of our own spiritual life is just all compressed from Palm Sunday to Easter morning and the subsequent appearances of Jesus. All our hopes, all our false expectations, all our disappointments, all our struggles, all our efforts, everything, it's just all right there. Isn't it the greatest story ever told? And then for 40 days, Jesus was there. And he would just appear here and there, you know, just sort of picking up the pieces, getting them all in order. And then he said, it's done. And he ascended. And he let them know that in that form, at least, he wasn't going to come back. I mean, he really came back. I was there where he was on the shore of the lake, and they were in the boats, and he was cooking fish, and there's the rock where he cooked fish. You know, you can sort of go in this big church, and there's the rock where Jesus cooked fish, and you can feel it. But he was really there with them. I mean, to give them that absolute conviction. They had seen him die. They had seen his body put into the tomb. And then he was just walking among them. And that was the power that, to this day, how could you doubt it? They couldn't doubt it. And then, like Paul, who never even knew him, had so much conviction from his visions and from his inner experience. It was just, and so he went to his death rather than repudiate it. How can you repudiate it? And that's the drama. That's what we're working for. That's what Swami's put into this music. So let's do now the last part. Mother, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master, Paramhansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, humbly we bow to you all. Beloved Christ, we are eternally grateful for your coming into this world, for your continuing presence, for your infinite love. Awaken within us pure devotion that we may be your instruments of love and enlightenment to all. Om. Peace. Amen. Let's gather all the beautiful divine energy we felt today, and rubbing our hands together, let's send it out into this world that all who have the receptive hearts to receive it will feel the love of Christ within. Oh.